Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season tomorrow night with a program titled Violet. Now, if you followed the orchestra this season, you know that each concert is devoted to pieces that suggest a given color. And in the case of Violet, it's Mozart's utterly sublime Piano Concerto No. 21 with longtime OK Mozart favorite Robin Sutherland as soloist. And the second half is devoted to Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 4, known as The Romantic, piece of power, solemnity, and of occasion. Leading the orchestra is Daniel Hege, music director of the Wichita Symphony Orchestra. He's previously served for 11 seasons as the music director of the Syracuse Symphony and served as associate and resident conductors at the Baltimore Symphony and the Kansas City Symphony, among others. He appears with regional orchestras and at summer festivals around the country. He's made several recordings, including a disc with the Baltimore Symphony featuring the works of Adolphus Hailstork, and a CD with the Syracuse Symphony with works by Verdi, Barber, Debussy, Respighi, and James Johnson. He's been a regular guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, and he'll lead the orchestra tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center in Violet. He joins me today as my guest on Studio Tulsa. Daniel Hege, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
You've got a great, interesting program. Usually on a program, you'll have an overture or a short orchestral work, a concerto, and then a symphony. This time, it's just a big concerto and a big symphony in the form of Mozart and Bruckner. Tell us a little bit about the program.
Well, I think it's a fantastic program. I think that Mozart and Bruckner pair very well together because you have with Mozart these very transparent and slender textures you have with a smaller orchestra in general. And this is one of the most beloved concertos of Mozart's. And that's saying a lot because almost all of Mozart's piano concertos are beloved. But this was right up there at the top, very well known. And then on the second half, we have this massive Bruckner symphony. It's about 70 minutes. So even for Bruckner, that's not one of his longest. But you know, just over an hour. And it's very grand and very romantic. So it has very different kind of textures. It does have textures that are Mozart-like, but it's much busier and thicker in other ways, which would be a sign of the time of when it was written.
In these two pieces, you sort of have the bookends of the Vienna, of Vienna as a city, too.
That's true. You do hear that kind of tradition there, that musical capital that it was. Bruckner, of course, came more from the outside of Vienna at the beginning, and he started his studies. He was very serious as a school teacher and also as an organist and taking his contrapuntal lessons very seriously. And he kind of worked his way up and then ended up in Vienna.
And, of course, when we think of Bruckner, you know, you have these great symphonies, and then you have these incredible choral works by him that perhaps most people don't know today, but I think some of the choral works are some of his finest pieces.
The motets and the masses. I got into those early when I was very young, and I got to sing some of them when I was in high school. And I remember thinking, this is just otherworldly music, just really fantastic. The writing, the kind of chord progressions he could find, and the kind of harmonies are actually, even though he's considered kind of looking backwards in some ways, you can find almost a medieval quality to his contrapuntal writing or Baroque. But in many ways, he's very modern. It's like he's got a foot in both worlds. He's very much looking to the future as well. If you look at some of those ninths, 11th, and 13th chords, they're really stacked up. And some of them, there's some really strange dissonances that take a while to resolve. So Bruckner is a fascinating composer. And you find that in his choral works. You find it also in his symphonic works.
Yeah. So how do you approach these two pieces? Because the Mozart, you have to have that wonderful transparency of Mozart. But this is a big concerto. I mean, it really is.
It really is. It is a big concerto. I mean, it's written, you know, more toward the end of Mozart's life. Of course, he was very young when he died. He was only 35 years old, and these are written close to when he's 30. So we're talking very mature Mozart at this point. They're big in the sense that they're well-developed, and the interplay of the themes and everything is highly developed. But it never gets to a massive sound. I mean, even for its day, it was not big in the sense that we think of big today. We look through the lens of Bruckner looking backwards, it seems small by comparison. But in terms of the size of the concerto, in terms of the length, for example, its development, it is pretty big. I mean, you know, a good 30 minutes or so.
That's what I was getting at, the idea of he really fully develops the form, which musicians know as the sonata allegro form. And the interesting thing about it is you hear themes from other pieces, too. There's a horn concerto theme in the piece. There's all sorts of wonderful moments.
Yeah, he's able to easily interchange different motives from different works and just put them in, and it seems absolutely natural for him to do it. The sonata allegro form that you're talking about in the first movement is established almost like a symphony. When you think of the form, the only thing that we're adding is that we have an orchestral exposition like you would have in a symphony, and then you have the solo exposition, and it has the same development section and recapitulation. So it really is grand in that sense.
Yeah. You'll be working with Robin Sutherland, a wonderful pianist who has ties to this area through his many appearances at the OK Mozart Festival. We think of him here as a sort of a Mozart specialist because a lot of times he was performing Mozart at the festival.
Right. This will be my first time working with Robin, so I'm really looking forward to it. I've heard so much about him. I know he has connections, as you mentioned, here, so that's going to be a real delight to get to work with someone like him.
How do you approach working with a guest artist for the first time? Do you attempt to contact them ahead of time, or you just show up in the city and, well, hi, how do you do? How do you approach this work? What are the questions you ask as a conductor?
If it's something that is a fairly well-known piece, or it's something in the, we would say, in the orchestral canon, like this Mozart work, it's enough to get together about an hour and a half before the rehearsal. I like to have about an hour and a half with them, where we just talk through, and I have him usually play something, so I understand his tempos, the way he wants to phrase things, the way he wants to articulate, the way he wants to come out of the cadenza, and I really try to serve what the soloist's ideas are for, because the soloist is really the protagonist for the work, and so something that they want to do in their playing should be emulated in the orchestra part as well. So I try to understand what their idea is, and if there's something that where we have a difference on, then I ask them about or talk to them, but it's pretty easy to compromise. I've never had an issue with any soloist in the past, so I don't foresee any in the future. It's usually something where it's a very happy collaboration. And both the conductor and the soloist have expectations that the other is professional and prepared and knows the score, knows the part. And so with that expectation, it's very easy to get together and work it out.
And with a piece like this, your orchestra knows it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a matter of figuring out how to get through it together. Right?
Exactly, and make it very cohesive and get the right sound and the right balance and the right phrasing. And that usually can work itself out fairly well in the rehearsal, first rehearsal even.
You mentioned that expansive first movement, but of course the theme everyone knows. And actually, you know, for a long time, this concerto had the subtitle Elvira Madigan from its use in I think it was a Swedish movie or something.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And of course, nobody knows that movie at all now. And nobody says, well, who's Elvira Madigan?
Right.
But when you hear this theme from the second movement, you instantly know this work.
That's right. They used to be used as some mileage for people to bring them to the concert. You know, there's an Elvira Madigan, and everybody would be like, oh, yeah, that one. I know that one. But now, like you said, people don't know it, so you can't get any mileage out of the subtitle. It's been given by pop culture. But it's one of those things that you just have to say, trust me. When you hear the slow movement of this andante, this beautiful middle movement of the concerto, you will know it. And it is one of the most sublime creations Mozart ever created, which again, is saying a lot because he wrote so many great, great, great works.
You know, it's very easy to get lost in a sublime moment. What are your thoughts when you're doing a piece like that? Or there's other moments like that where it's just like this moment, a transcendent, you know, music making. What's going through a conductor's mind?
Well, certainly I'm enjoying and reveling in that moment too. But so from an emotional standpoint, I'm very invested in trying to make that come off, helping that come off, or allowing it to come off, whatever word you really want to use there. But I also have to stay very engaged mentally with what's happening, because I have a responsibility up there. And so one can't lose oneself too much. You can. It's really like you have to, in some ways, be a little bit divided. You have to be completely living in the moment. And that is understanding the emotional impact of what's happening. But you also have to be a leader. You also have to be someone who is still coordinating things. And you can't abandon anybody because you're lost in some moment of ecstasy. And so it's important to always have your mind attuned to everything that is going on. At the same time, your heart is 100% into it.
We always have to remember you're called a conductor for a reason. And like the train conductor, you got to make sure the train's on time.
Right. Well, you have to remember, you know, sometimes those moments come at fairly complicated moments in the music. And you can't just be sitting there getting into it at the expense of not aiding your players, who also have a very difficult job of executing their work that they have to do. So there is, I want to say, a balance, but it really has to kind of be 100% of both.
And when you hear a piece like this slow movement, it sounds like it plays itself. Does it?
In many ways, it does. Once you set the tempo and you have a certain feeling for it, we really, as an orchestra and conductor, I consider myself with them at this point, we're really listening to the soloist, and you do kind of allow it to happen. There is this slow kind of triplet motor rhythm that's going on in the orchestra, and the piano also plays it and plays the theme above it. And many times you can just be there to guide it. You don't have to do so much, because the best thing we can do, if we're playing with a soloist or even without a soloist, is simply listen. Listen to where the pulse is, listen to who has the melody, listen to how the bass line is being phrased, and all those other voices will sometimes take care of themselves.
Well, let's hear a little music from the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 21. This is one of the works to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night at 7:30. The Mozart Piano Concerto No. 21 will be performed by Robin Sutherland and my guest today, guest conductor Daniel Heggie, the music director of the Wichita Symphony Orchestra and guest conductor. Let's hear a portion of that slow movement.
Great.
It's music from the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 21, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, along with soloist Robin Sutherland, this Saturday night. My guest is guest conductor Daniel Heggie, as we talk about the music to be performed this weekend. And the other work, which we mentioned earlier, is the great Bruckner Symphony No. 4. You mentioned it's romantic, and I've actually done a little reading on it, and romantic was the term that Bruckner actually used.
Yes, and people have to know that romantic in this sense would be more of a reflection, I think, of the aesthetic of romantic or the period.
And he was actually thinking about medieval, like the Lohengrins and the Wagner, great Wagner stories, and that was sort of the romantic he was going for.
That's right. That's right. And although that's the title of it, and I can appreciate what he was thinking of when he's thinking back to this old kind of legend, I think it's important not to read too much into it when one is trying to listen to the music and trying to assign it to something specific. I think that it has its own quality to it. If you need that just as a starter, that's okay. But I think it gets a little bit dangerous when we try to label something too much. I mean, it's there as a suggestion, but really the music has its own life, and it creates a world of its own if we just listen to it and give ourselves over to it. It's really considered, I would consider it much more of absolute music, because there isn't a specific program. Even if there's something that may have inspired him, I would stop short of saying it's ever programmatic, because it doesn't really follow any particular story. It's not telling a story per se. It's telling whatever story the listener's bringing to it from their own life, whether it's nostalgia, they're looking back, or they're looking to the future. There's something that's stirring them emotionally.
And in this piece, you'll have moments of incredible grandeur.
Yes.
There are hunting songs. There's folk melodies. I mean, I always get the sense that there's just this bigness about Bruckner, even in a hunting song or a folk melody or sort of a folk celebration.
Well, I think the grandeur idea hits it right on the head. Right from the very beginning, we have very soft tremolo in the beginning, which is when the strings are playing their bows very quickly back and forth. It's just an E-flat, and we hear this beautiful sound of the horn that's going to come through. It's a big solo horn part at the very beginning. And it is as though it's calling from some other age. It could be from the past. It could be from the future. But it's from a different time. You're instantly placed in a different world. And it's just marvelous how it unfolds. Bruckner's music has an inevitability about it, a kind of inexorable pace that you're going to get to this fantastic destination, and you're going to enjoy the journey all the way through. All of the repetition that people hear in the Bruckner has to be that much repetition in order to get to the next change, the next harmonic change, or the next big event, the next big brass fanfare, or the next beautiful, sumptuous melody that's in the first violins or in the woodwinds. It always needs the amount of time that it takes to get from one place to another. So sometimes when people are listening to Bruckner, they say, boy, this is going on for a bit. But, you know, you can't cut a note. You can't cut a bar. You can't cut this theme, because this theme is necessary to understand the next theme and is necessary to take on the next event. Otherwise, it doesn't work dramatically. And the piece works extremely well in a dramatic sense. When we talk about a composer figuring out how much tension there has to be before there's release, they can do that through harmony, they can do it through form, they can do it through rhythm, in order to create tension, just like an author would in a book, creating a hero and a villain. There has to be these two sides that are pushing against each other to form the drama. And Bruckner does it in his own way. His music is very spacious, it's very melodic, but what you find with all of the instruments in the orchestra is they all have a special role, that they're playing these little parts, like a very intricate machine, that over time, you know, you can change the harmony by just changing just the second clarinet, and the whole chord shifts. It's almost like steering a massive ship by just turning the rudder just by an inch. All of a sudden, you're going to end up in some completely different destination by the time you end up on the shoreline somewhere. It's like that with Bruckner, and it's the effect is magical. These brass fanfares, the beautiful woodwind chorales, and the string writing. If everyone really listens actively, they'll hear that Bruckner, of course, was an organist, and that when you hear these different colors of sound, it's as though he's pulling stops on the organ. And you also hear the sense of a kind of a silence before moving on into a different theme. That would be a cathedral-like quality to it, where we have this optimal resonance, because that's what he was used to. He was a church organist.
And it's interesting you mentioned the church organ, because the idea of maybe switching one finger, you know, as you're holding a chord, you get the new sonority. He's doing this, you know, an organist does the same thing, say, during a time of quiet prayer when he's very softly accompanying it. It will be a fixed chord. He's doing what Bruckner's doing in the symphony in many regards, of just changing a note here and there, and all of a sudden the sonority changes completely.
The sonority changes, and then the feeling internally for the listener changes too. Because we can go from a moment of great tension to great release, or the other way around. Something that sounds like we're completely at peace and there's nothing wrong, all of a sudden, this other note will enter in, and it starts to sound, it can almost sound sinister in some ways, and then it has to be resolved again. And that's the way we get carried through the work.
One of the problems involved with playing Bruckner's symphonies, and especially this one, I think, is which Bruckner Symphony No. 4 do you play? Because he was an inveterate tinkerer with this symphony in particular, maybe all. But there's three established versions, and of those three versions, there are probably five or six different. He was revising it year by year.
Yeah.
And when you actually look at recordings of the Bruckner 4, there are recordings of every one of those different versions.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. Basically, the Bruckner symphonies in general are kind of a can of worms. There seem to be, for most of the symphonies, some sort of multiple editions. And that was partly because Bruckner's genius was beyond what many of his friends that he showed the scores to. His genius was beyond them. And I don't think they understood what he was.
So it was a matter of somebody's going to perform this and go, you got to cut this. This is just not
exactly
going to work.
Yeah.
And he would say, okay, do whatever you want.
his strength was, as an intellectual, was great, was tremendous as a composer. I mean, he truly was a genius. But socially, he was weak. And so when he would go to a friend, and the so-called friend or someone who would advise him, they would look at it and kind of treat him like he was someone who didn't always know what he was doing. That's partly because Bruckner socially and personally kind of came off like he was a little kind of a bumpkin, you know, mm-hmm. kind of like he was just fell off the turnip truck or something like that. He had kind of frumpy clothes, and he was short, kind of homely, didn't always seem to take care of himself.
From the provinces. Yeah,
yeah, he just didn't. He didn't come off as being sophisticated.
Yeah, he wasn't a sophisticated Viennese, yeah.
And yet some of the friends he would talk with or acquaintances, some people would advise him, they considered themselves very sophisticated. They would look at his scores and just kind of say, oh, yeah, this won't work. I think he was just so far beyond them, they didn't know. But so he would still say, oh, okay, and he would be filled with this self-doubt. Maybe I do need to change. But I think that came from how he saw himself personally. And didn't realize that maybe he was writing beyond them. And so he ended up tinkering. And maybe in some cases, because with anybody, if you rethink something, sometimes you do refine it and you do make it better. But sometimes your original idea is also very great. And I think what we have for this performance, it's a very good edition that's done by Robert Haas. He's one of the great editors. And Leopold Novak is the other one who have gone through these scores meticulously and gathered information from different parts, have looked at Bruckner's changes and brought them together. And I went through the score very carefully to say, yeah, this is the one that I want.
Mm. And how big a difference are there between the various versions? Is it a matter of... You mentioned that sort of the time you have to spend, some of that time gets cut out in some of the versions, right?
Yeah, there are cuts here and there. The one that I'm using is really like the final, it matches the final version that Leopold Novak also did too. And so there isn't any change at the very end there between those two versions, any cuts. But there are little voicing changes in the chords, and there's some tempo additions that are in there that should be there just for clarity. So I'm very happy with this edition that we have.
You mentioned earlier pacing, and I think any time you have a work of an hour or more, pacing is crucial. And you have so many, that first big climax in the beginning of the first movement. I mean, that could be a finale of a symphony written 30, 40 years earlier.
It could. I think there are several things you have to look at in Bruckner, as you would with any composer, and that is to see really how it's constructed. You really have to know the form very well. You have to understand, okay, this is the first statement of this theme. This is where the tension comes. This is where the development begins. This is where the recapitulation comes. This is where the coda comes. This is where he's truncating the harmony. You have to really understand it very well. And then once you understand it, I think then it's easier to pace. Because you know that it has to stretch in some places, and this is where we want the most sound. This is where we don't want as much sound. Because composers will put in, fortissimo, two Fs to play very loudly.
They don't always mean it.
Right. Well, they kind of mean this should be really loud here, but do you make this one a little louder than the other one? And should this be a bigger moment here? And Bruckner rarely, but very effectively, uses three Fs in several places. There are three places, actually, that he uses three Fs in the first movement. And then if you look at the other movements, there's one place in the second movement, there's one place in the third movement, and a couple places in the last movement. So you want to make sure that you're pacing it in terms of the sound that way. But also the places where you take a little time before you give a structural downbeat. This might sound really boring to the listeners, but hopefully when they're listening to it, they don't have to be thinking about that, but they're just kind of carried along. If you make every big moment like a climax, it pulls away from the drama of the work. I think you have to have a long view with Bruckner.
Well, sounds like you've spent a lot of time with this score.
You have to. And the thing is, I'm a real Bruckner nut. I mean, I love his music. His music spoke to me immediately when I was young. And so I never understood when someone didn't get Bruckner.
There are people who do not get Bruckner. You have to admit that.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I've talked to them, but I don't know how to explain getting it. I remember there was a player once in an orchestra years ago who said, Daniel, I know you're really into Bruckner, but can you take me through the score sometime and show me why that is? I said, I don't. If you don't get it, I'm not sure I can explain it to you because it's just something about the mystical quality of his music. You kind of have to just listen and it'll just take over. You know, it's interesting because Mahler and Bruckner, they overlapped. And so sometimes people talking about, especially when they're talking about the length of symphonies, the profundity of the symphonies, and the size of the orchestras, they'll often compare those two together. But those
and a lot of times Bruckner comes off the worst between the comparisons.
Right, because his music, if you just look at it from a purely superficial standpoint, it has a more staid quality. It's more static. It's not static music, but compared to Mahler, who has these sforzandos and all these different kinds of a different way of using the counterpoint of themes, the Bruckner seems rather gray by comparison, I suppose, in terms of orchestration too. But I guess I would say you need to accept Bruckner on his own terms and see what he's trying to say, because it's not the same story that Mahler is telling. It's a different story. And there's a sincerity to Bruckner's music that if you listen closely, it will tell you maybe more about yourself than any other composer.
And when you look at currents in classical music and also in certain other music forms like New Age, I'm going to say New Age music, you know, there's a static quality in a lot of those compositions. Certainly in minimalism, you have a lot of times the rhythmic tension, but a lot of times the harmonic tension is much like mm-hmm. Bruckner in many ways.
It is. I guess the distinction I would make between, and I've heard that Bruckner was, you know, thought of as kind of a proto minimalist in a sense. There is that, I guess if you look at the actual motives and things that are repeated by different instruments and moving towards something else, one could make a comparison. But for me, I would go back to what I said earlier, that sometimes with minimalism, I don't feel like it's doing something for a certain length of time in order to give way to something. It's simply doing that thing for a while, and now it's doing something else. Bruckner's always feels like there's a purpose. There's a reason why it starts to speed up, or the motives go twice as fast, or the harmonic changes happen now not only on the bar, but on the half bar, and now every quarter note. And so it's that sense of this kind of mechanistic way of putting all the music together has to give way to something else. So it has that inexorable quality. It's always moving to this other destination, and so there's no way to take anything away from it because it's required in order to get to the next place.
And you also have these great themes that are sort of born out of that Austrian tradition, and you know, the hunting songs and the Volk melodies and things like that are part of all of his works.
Exactly. The third movement of this fourth symphony has that hunting call quality to it, and it's just fantastic music. It's just absolutely visceral. I mean, we're talking about this, about how he was perceived by others as being kind of this bumpkin, you know, from out in the provinces. But he wrote music that was just absolutely hair-raising. I mean, the hunting calls of the third movement, and then the contrasting trio is just as countryside and pastoral as one could possibly get. But for me, the great thing about Bruckner is just it feels so profound. It feels like sometimes he's the aural incarnate of when you see a great, great cathedral, or when you see something so awe-inspiring, like a great mountain or a fantastic lake or the ocean or something. It's that kind of grandeur.
Just got to sit down and look.
But you just.
In this case, listen.
And in this case, just sit and listen, because as you listen to it, you will hear the whole thing being just erected right there in front of you.
Well, you'll have a chance to hear it this weekend, Saturday night at 7:30, with the Mozart Piano Concerto, Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 4 by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. Daniel, we look forward to the performance this weekend. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
Daniel Heggie, music director of the Wichita Symphony Orchestra, leads the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in Violet, featuring works by Mozart and Bruckner, tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. For ticket information, call the PAC box office at 918-596-7111 or visit TulsaSymphony.org. We're going to leave you with music from Bruckner's Symphony No. 4 here on Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.